A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been up close to Israel's border fences more times than most of us ever will be, and he keeps noticing the same thing. What looks like one line on a map turns into three parallel fences on the ground, because each army declares a closed military zone. Each country builds its own fence to keep its own citizens out, and suddenly you've got a strip of desert with three barriers running through it, and no obvious answer to the question of which one is actually the border.
And he wants to talk about the physical objects themselves. Not the sensors, not the cameras, not the radar. The civil engineering. Who designs these things? Who pours the concrete and welds the steel? Who drives out to the middle of nowhere to fix a fence that somebody tried to cut through at 3 a.m?
He's also asking how Israel's fences changed over time. The Jordan border was one of the last unfenced stretches, and for years what fencing existed was chain link you'd see around a horse paddock. Then you've got the Egyptian border with these towering steel barriers, and the Gaza fence, which was supposed to be the most sophisticated border barrier on the planet until October 7th.
Right. And the thing he really wants to get at is the engineering trade-off. A fence has to be affordable, maintainable, and able to resist a bulldozer or a pair of steel cutters. Those requirements pull in completely different directions, and that's why border defenses are almost never just one fence.
So, before we get into who builds these things, I want to sit with the puzzle Daniel opened with. Why does one border become three fences?
It comes down to how countries think about their own territory. Each side declares a closed military zone along the border. The fence goes inside that zone. It's not marking the exact international boundary. It's marking the edge of where civilians are allowed to go.
So the fence is really a people barrier, not a border marker.
The actual border is a surveyed line that exists on paper and in treaty annexes. The fence is just a physical thing that keeps your own population from wandering across it. And since both countries want to keep their own citizens out, both countries build a fence. You end up with two national fences and a strip of no man's land between them.
And sometimes there's a third fence in the middle, or a line of posts marking the actual survey boundary. So you've got three parallel lines, and the real border is the one in the middle that nobody can actually reach.
That's the part that messes with your head when you see it in person. You're standing at a fence, looking across a strip of scrubland, and there's another fence on the far side. Which one is the border? The answer is neither, exactly. The border is a line somewhere in that strip, possibly marked by a post you can barely see, possibly not marked at all.
Daniel mentioned Metula. The northern border with Lebanon has exactly this quality. You stand at the edge of town and there's a fence, and then a stretch of land, and then another fence, and somewhere in there's the international boundary. It's ambiguous to the naked eye.
And the ambiguity matters because the space between the fences is where a lot of the tension lives. It's not quite your territory, not quite theirs. It's a strip of ground that both sides watch and neither side wants to be caught standing in.
Let's pull back to the evolution Daniel described. He said the Jordan border was among the last unfenced stretches, and for most of its history, the fencing was chain link that looked like farm fencing. That's not a security barrier. That's a property marker.
And that's the key distinction. For decades, Israel's borders were marked, not defended. The chain link fence along the Jordan border did nothing to stop a determined person. It stopped a cow. Maybe. The assumption was that the terrain and the military presence did the actual work of security.
So when did the shift happen from marker to fortification?
The Egyptian border is the clearest example. After the fall of Mubarak in 2011, the Sinai became a lawless corridor. Smuggling, human trafficking, and eventually jihadist activity spiked. The old fence was a joke. Israel built a new one, and it's a completely different object. Tall steel panels, designed to be cut-resistant, installed along hundreds of kilometers of desert.
I've seen photographs. It looks like something you'd see around a military installation, not a border.
The design logic is straightforward. height to make climbing difficult, steel composition to resist hand tools, and a smooth surface that's hard to get a purchase on. It's not impenetrable, but it's designed to make breaching take time and make noise. The psychological deterrent matters too. A towering steel fence sends a different message than a sagging chain-link fence.
But the Gaza barrier is the real case study. Daniel called it the smart fence, completed in 2021, and it was supposed to be the most sophisticated border barrier in the world. Underground concrete to block tunnels, tall steel above ground, and a sensor array on top.
The underground wall was the novel part. Hamas had spent years digging tunnels under the old fence, some of them deep enough to evade detection. The new barrier drove concrete deep into the ground, designed to make tunneling physically impossible. You can't dig through 40 meters of reinforced concrete with shovels.
And above ground, the steel fence was designed to resist breaching. Cut resistant steel, sensors embedded in the structure, cameras every few hundred meters. The whole thing was a layered system.
The engineering is impressive. The concrete barrier had to be poured in place, section by section, along a border that was actively hostile. The steel panels had to be manufactured to spec, transported, and installed under fire. The sensor array had to be calibrated to distinguish between a bird, a farmer, and a breach attempt.
And then October 7th happened, and the whole thing failed.
Not partially, completely. Hamas didn't go under the wall, they went through it. Bulldozers punched holes in the steel fence. Explosives blew gaps. Steel cutters went through panels that were supposed to be cut resistant. The sensors were overwhelmed or disabled. The response was late.
The underground wall was irrelevant because the attack didn't use tunnels. It used the surface. And the surface barrier, which was supposed to delay a breach, didn't delay it long enough.
That's the engineering postmortem in one sentence. The barrier was optimized for a tunnel threat, and the attack came through the front door. The steel fence was cut through in minutes, not hours.
So the question Daniel raised, whether this particular kind of steel fence can be cut through, is answered. Yes, it can be cut through. It was cut through, repeatedly, in a coordinated assault.
And that forces the deeper question. What's a border fence actually for? If you can't make it impenetrable, what are you buying with all that steel and concrete?
Time. You're buying time.
That's the answer, and it's the thing most coverage gets wrong. A border fence isn't a wall that stops people. It's a delay mechanism. It slows a breach long enough for sensors to detect it and for a response force to arrive. The fence isn't the defense. The response is the defense.
Which means the engineering trade-off isn't about making something uncuttable. It's about making something that takes long enough to cut that the cavalry gets there.
And that reframes the design choices. A solid concrete wall would be harder to cut through than a steel fence, but it blocks observation. Soldiers on one side can't see what's happening on the other. A steel fence lets you see through it, which means you can observe the other side without exposing yourself, but it can be cut.
So the choice of steel over concrete is a trade-off between observability and resistance. You give up some resistance to gain situational awareness.
And you give up some resistance to control cost. Concrete walls are expensive to build and expensive to maintain. Steel fences are cheaper per kilometer and easier to repair. When you're building hundreds of kilometers of barrier, those costs multiply fast.
There's no perfect solution, only trade-offs. That's the whole story of border engineering.
Let's talk about who actually builds these things, because that's the part Daniel specifically asked about, and it's the part most people never think about.
Right. Somebody has to pour that concrete and weld that steel. Who?
In Israel, the Ministry of Defense has an engineering and construction division that handles a lot of this work directly. They define requirements, produce specifications, and oversee construction. But the actual building is done by private contractors. The Gaza barrier was built by a consortium of Israeli firms, each handling a different piece of the project.
So the government says what it needs, engineers design a solution, and contractors build it. Standard procurement.
Standard procurement, but with unusual constraints. The construction site is a live border. Workers are building a fence while the other side is watching, sometimes shooting. The concrete has to be poured under fire. The steel has to be installed in a hurry. The logistics are brutal.
And then there's the maintenance problem. A border fence isn't a static object. It rusts, it sags, it gets damaged by weather, it gets cut by people trying to cross. Somebody has to fix all of that.
the maintenance regime is constant. For something like the Egyptian border fence, you're talking about hundreds of kilometers of steel in a desert environment. Sand gets into everything. The galvanization degrades. The panels shift. Military engineers handle some of it, but civilian contractors are out there too, driving along the fence line, checking welds, replacing damaged panels.
In remote areas, that's a logistical nightmare. You need water, fuel, spare parts, and a crew willing to work in the middle of nowhere, sometimes under threat.
And the maintenance isn't optional. A fence with a hole in it isn't a fence. The whole point is that there are no holes, or at least that holes are detected and repaired quickly. If maintenance slips, the delay function degrades. A breach that should take 15 minutes takes 5.
So the maintenance crew is part of the security system. They're not just fixing infrastructure, they're maintaining the delay.
The welder who repairs a cut panel is doing security work, even if he never carries a weapon.
Let's go back to the three fences phenomenon, because Daniel asked about the coordination problem, and I don't think we've fully answered it.
The short answer is that countries mostly don't coordinate. Each side builds its own fence on its own side of the border, according to its own threat model and budget. There's no treaty specifying fence height or steel thickness.
So you get two fences built to completely different standards, facing each other across a strip of no man's land.
And the no man's land becomes its own problem. Who maintains it? Who's responsible if someone gets stuck in there? Who responds if there's a fire? In practice, the answer is often nobody, or the military on whichever side happens to notice.
The ambiguity about which fence is the border isn't just a philosophical curiosity. It has practical consequences. If someone crosses the first fence but not the second, have they crossed the border? The answer depends on which fence is the actual boundary, and sometimes that's not clear.
In some places, the actual border is marked by a third line between the two national fences. A line of posts, or a low fence, or just survey markers. That's the real border, and it's often the least impressive object in the whole ensemble.
Two serious fences and a line of sticks in the middle. The sticks are the border.
That's the absurdity of it. The most important line is the least defended because it's not defended at all, it's just marked.
Let's compare with the Saudi approach, because Daniel mentioned wanting to look at this generally, and the Saudi border wall with Iraq is a useful contrast.
The Saudis took a different trade-off. Their system is more about detection than physical obstruction. Airbus radar, fiber optic sensors buried in the ground, a command and control network. The physical barrier is there, but it's not the star of the show. The sensors are.
So they're leaning harder on the detect and respond side of the equation, and less on the delay side.
Right. The Saudi threat model is different. They're worried about infiltration and smuggling across a long, empty border. They don't need a towering steel fence because the terrain itself is a barrier. They need to know when someone crosses, and they need to get a response there fast.
Israel's threat model is different. The borders are shorter, the population density is higher, and the threat is more immediate. So the physical barrier does more work.
Different countries, different trade-offs based on different threat models and budgets. There's no universal answer to what a border fence should look like.
And that's the thing about the future. As breaching techniques evolve, the trade-offs shift. Drones can fly over fences. Cyber attacks can blind sensors. Tunneling gets more sophisticated. No physical barrier is going to hold forever.
The fundamental limit is that any physical barrier can be breached with enough time, resources, and determination. The question is whether the barrier buys enough time for a response. That's the whole game.
So the future of border engineering is probably less about making fences stronger and more about making responses faster. Automated systems, drones, AI-driven surveillance. The fence becomes a sensor platform, not a wall.
And that connects back to what Daniel said about not wanting to talk about the electronic measures. The electronics are the future. The civil engineering is the foundation. You need both, but the balance is shifting.
October 7th showed what happens when the balance is wrong. The physical barrier was there, the sensors were there, but the response was too slow. The delay didn't buy enough time.
The fence did its job in a narrow sense. It delayed the breach. But the delay wasn't long enough, and the response didn't arrive in time. The system failed as a system, not just as a fence.
That's the lesson. The engineering is impressive, but the system is only as strong as its weakest link. And on October 7th, multiple links failed at once.
The underground wall was irrelevant. The steel fence was cut. The sensors were overwhelmed. The response was late. 4 layers all failed.
It's a reminder that redundancy only helps if the layers fail independently. If they all fail for the same reason, you've got nothing.
And the same reason, in this case, was that the attack was designed to overwhelm the system. Not to sneak through it, but to hit it with so much force so fast that the delay function collapsed.
So the engineering question for the future isn't how to make a fence that can't be cut. It's how to make a system that can't be overwhelmed. That's a much harder problem.
Much harder. Because it's not a civil engineering problem anymore. It's a command and control problem, a response time problem, a force deployment problem. The fence is just one input.
Let's talk about the people who actually deploy these things, because Daniel asked specifically about that. Who drives out to the border and fixes the fence?
It's a mix. The military has engineer units that handle a lot of the routine maintenance and emergency repairs. But there are also civilian contractors, often the same firms that built the fence in the first place, who come back for major repairs or upgrades.
So the construction consortium doesn't just build and leave. They're on retainer, in a sense.
For something like the Gaza barrier, yes. The firms that built it have ongoing contracts for maintenance and repair. They know the specifications, they have the equipment, they have the crews. It's more efficient than training military engineers to do everything.
And the crews themselves? Who are these people?
Steel workers, welders, concrete specialists, heavy equipment operators. People who could just as easily be building a warehouse or a bridge. They're doing the same work, just in a more dangerous location.
I imagine the pay reflects the danger.
It does. Working on a border fence pays better than working on a warehouse, because the risk is higher. You're within sight of the other side. You might be shot at. The work is the same, but the context is completely different.
And the maintenance crews are out there every day, driving along the fence line, checking for damage. That's a job that never ends.
Never. A border fence is like a road. It's never finished. You're always repairing, replacing, upgrading. The day you stop maintaining, it's the day it stops being a barrier.
So the fence isn't a thing you build. It's a thing you sustain.
That's the point. The construction is impressive, but the maintenance is the real ongoing cost. And the maintenance is what determines whether the fence actually works when it's needed.
Let's go back to the Jordan border for a second, because Daniel mentioned it specifically, and I think it's a good example of the evolution.
For decades, the Jordan border was mostly unfenced. The terrain did the work. The Jordan Valley is steep, rugged, and hard to cross. A fence was almost redundant.
And where there were fences, they were chain link, farm style, not designed to stop anyone, just marking the line.
That changed over time. As the security situation evolved, the fencing got more serious. The chain link got replaced with something more substantial. The unfenced stretches got fenced. By now, it's pretty much entirely closed, as Daniel said.
So the evolution isn't just about the technology, it's about the threat. When the threat was low, a marker fence was enough. When the threat rose, the fence had to become a barrier.
And that's the general pattern. Border fences evolve in response to specific threats. The Egyptian fence was a response to Sinai lawlessness. The Gaza barrier was a response to tunnels. The northern fence is a response to Hezbollah. Each fence is a product of its specific context.
Which means you can't just copy a fence design from one border to another. The threat model is different. The terrain is different. The budget is different.
And the political context is different. A fence on the Jordan border means something different than a fence on the Gaza border. The engineering is shaped by all of that.
So when Daniel asks who engineers these fortifications, the answer isn't just a list of firms. It's a whole ecosystem of threat assessment, requirements definition, design, construction, and maintenance.
The civil engineers are the ones who turn a security requirement into a physical object. They're the ones who figure out how deep the concrete has to go, how thick the steel has to be, how tall the fence needs to be. They're translating policy into steel and concrete.
And they're doing it under constraints that most engineers never face. The construction site is hostile. The requirements are classified. The stakes are existential.
It's a strange niche. Border fence engineering isn't a field you study in school. It's something you learn by doing it, usually after years of working on more conventional infrastructure.
I wonder how many firms actually specialize in this. It can't be a huge market.
It's not. There are a handful of firms worldwide that do serious border barrier work. The rest are general contractors who happen to get a border fence contract because they're local and they can handle the logistics.
So it's a small world. The people who built the Gaza barrier probably know the people who built the Saudi fence, at least by reputation.
Probably. It's a niche within a niche, civil engineering with a security clearance.
Let's pull on the maintenance thread a bit more, because I think that's where the real story is.
The maintenance regime for something like the Egyptian border fence is relentless. You've got hundreds of kilometers of steel in a desert environment. Sand gets into everything. The galvanization degrades. The panels shift with temperature changes. Every weld is a potential failure point.
And every failure point is a potential breach. So the inspection has to be thorough.
Thorough and constant. The fence is inspected on a schedule, but also after every attempted breach, every storm, every incident. If someone tries to cut through and fails, the fence still has to be repaired. The cut marks are a vulnerability.
So the fence accumulates its history. Every repair is a record of an attempted breach.
The repair itself might be weaker than the original. A welded patch isn't the same as the original panel. The galvanization is broken. The steel is stressed. The fence degrades over time, even with perfect maintenance.
That's a sobering thought. The barrier is slowly degrading, and every repair makes it a little bit weaker.
Which is why the maintenance isn't just about fixing damage. It's about managing decline. You're trying to keep the fence at a certain level of effectiveness, knowing that it's slowly getting worse.
The alternative is replacement. At some point, a section of fence is so damaged that it's cheaper to replace it than to keep patching it.
Replacement is a major project. You're back to the original construction problem. Hostile site, tight schedule, high stakes.
The life cycle of a border fence is build, maintain, repair, replace. It's a cycle that never ends.
The cycle is driven by the threat. If the threat goes away, you can let the fence degrade. If the threat rises, you have to accelerate the maintenance and replacement.
Let's talk about the Saudi comparison again, because I think it illuminates something important about the Israeli approach.
The Saudi system is more about detection than physical obstruction. They've got Airbus radar and fiber optic sensors buried in the ground. The physical barrier is there, but it's not the main event.
They're betting that they can detect a breach early and respond fast, rather than trying to make the barrier hard to cross.
Right. And that makes sense for their context. The Saudi-Iraqi border is long, empty, and remote. A towering steel fence would be enormously expensive and hard to maintain. Better to have a lighter physical barrier and a heavy sensor network.
Israel's context is different. The borders are shorter, the population is denser, and the threat is more immediate. So the physical barrier does more work.
But October 7th suggests that even Israel's heavier physical barrier wasn't enough. The delay function failed. The response was too slow.
Which raises the question of whether the Israeli approach is actually the right one, or whether it's a product of historical inertia.
That's a hard question. The Israeli approach evolved in response to specific threats, and it worked for a long time. The Gaza barrier was breached, but that doesn't mean the whole approach is wrong. It means the approach has limits.
The limits are human. The fence can't respond. The sensors can't respond. Only people can respond. And people take time.
The future is probably about reducing the human response time. More automation, more drones, more AI-driven surveillance. The fence becomes a sensor platform, and the response becomes faster.
Which brings us back to the electronic measures that Daniel didn't want to talk about. The civil engineering is the foundation, but the electronics are the future.
The electronics are evolving fast. Drones can patrol a fence line autonomously. AI can analyze sensor data in real time. The response can be dispatched in seconds, not minutes.
But all of that's only as good as the data. If the sensors are overwhelmed, the AI is useless. If the drones are jammed, they're useless. The system is only as strong as its weakest link.
October 7th showed that the weakest link can be the human element. The sensors detected the breach, but the response was too slow. The humans in the loop failed.
The future isn't just about better technology. It's about better integration. The fence, the sensors, the drones, the response force, all working as one system.
That's a command and control problem, not a civil engineering problem. The engineers build the physical object. The military operates it. The gap between those two is where failures happen.
Let's go back to the three fences phenomenon one more time, because I think there's a deeper point there.
The deeper point is that borders aren't lines, they're zones. The space between the fences is part of the border, even if it's not exactly anyone's territory.
That zone is a strange kind of place. It's not quite war, not quite peace. It's a strip of land that exists in a state of permanent ambiguity.
The ambiguity is the point. Neither side wants to control that strip. Both sides want to keep their own people out of it, so it stays empty, watched, and undefined.
The fences are the physical expression of that ambiguity. They're not the border. They're the edge of the zone that contains the border.
Which is why the question of which fence is the border is so hard to answer. The border isn't a fence. It's a line on a map that happens to run through a strip of land between two fences.
The line itself is invisible. You can stand right on it and not know.
Unless there's a marker, a post, a survey stone, a line of stakes. Something that says, this is the line.
That marker is the least impressive object in the whole ensemble. Two serious fences and a stick in the ground.
The stick is the border. The fences are just the edges of the zone.
That's the thing Daniel was getting at. The physical boundaries are fascinating because they're so much more complicated than they look. A line on a map becomes a zone on the ground, and the zone is defined by fences that aren't even the border.
The fences themselves are fascinating objects. They're engineered to resist bulldozers and steel cutters, but they're also just steel and concrete, subject to rust and wear and the slow degradation of time.
They're monuments to the impossibility of perfect security. No matter how tall, how thick, how well maintained, they can be breached. They're a statement of intent, not a guarantee.
That's the thing to remember. A border fence is a message. It says, we care about this line, we're willing to spend money to defend it. But it's not a wall that stops time. It's a delay mechanism, and the delay can fail.
The engineering is impressive, but the system is only as strong as its weakest link, and the weakest link is usually the human one.
The person who has to notice the breach, sound the alarm, and send the response. That person is the real border fence.
That person can be overwhelmed, just like the sensors. Too many alerts, too little time, too much confusion.
October 7th, in one sentence, the humans were overwhelmed.
The future of border engineering is about making the humans harder to overwhelm. Better information, faster response, more automation.
That's not a civil engineering problem anymore. It's a systems problem.
Let's bring it back to Daniel's original question. Who actually engineers these fortifications?
Civil engineers working for defense ministries and private contractors. People who know how to pour concrete and weld steel, who understand soil mechanics and structural loads, who can design something that stands up to a bulldozer.
Who deploys and maintains them?
Military engineer units and civilian contractors. The same people who built them, often coming back to repair and replace. A small world of specialists who know how to work on a live border.
The fences themselves aren't just stronger fences. They're multifaceted systems with underground barriers, above-ground steel, and sensor arrays. The civil engineering is one layer in a larger system.
The system is designed around a simple principle: delay, detect, respond. The fence delays, the sensors detect, the response force responds. The fence isn't the defense. The response is the defense.
That's the thing that most coverage gets wrong. The fence isn't a wall. It's a speed bump.
A very expensive speed bump.
A speed bump that costs millions per kilometer and requires constant maintenance.
Yet, it's still cheaper than the alternative. The alternative is having soldiers every few hundred meters along the entire border, forever. The fence lets you concentrate your forces and respond to breaches instead of guarding every meter.
The fence is a force multiplier. It lets a small number of soldiers defend a long border by slowing the enemy down.
That's the real engineering achievement. Not the steel, not the concrete, but the way the physical barrier changes the economics of defense.
The fence makes defense cheaper. That's its real value.
That's why countries keep building them, even knowing they can be breached. Because the alternative is worse.
Let's talk about the future one more time. Because I think there's something important about where this is going.
The future is automated. Drones that patrol the fence line, AI that analyzes sensor data, automated response systems that can intercept a breach before a human even knows it happened.
The fence itself becomes less important. It's still there, still doing its delay function, but the real work is done by the sensors and the response systems.
the fence becomes a sensor platform, a place to mount cameras and radar and fiber optic cables. The physical barrier is secondary.
Which is a strange evolution. The fence started as a marker, became a barrier, and is now becoming a platform.
The platform is more valuable than the barrier. The information is worth more than the steel.
The civil engineering is still important, but it's no longer the main event. The main event is the information.
The information is only useful if there's someone to act on it. The human in the loop is still essential.
The human who notices, decides, and responds. That person is the real border fence.
That person can be overwhelmed. That's the lesson of October 7th.
The future is about making that person's job easier. Better information, clearer alerts, faster response.
That's a hard problem. Harder than building a fence.
Harder than building a fence, and more important.
I built part of that fence.
Which one?
The Egyptian border fence, early 2000s. I was a junior engineer for a contractor that did a section of it, quality control on the steel panels, checking welds, measuring thickness, making sure the galvanization was up to spec.
You were the guy with the calipers.
Calipers, ultrasonic thickness gauge, a clipboard. I spent 6 months looking at welds. The spec was tight. The steel had to be a certain thickness. The galvanization had to be a certain depth. The welds had to be continuous, no gaps. A gap in a weld is a place where a cutter can get purchased.
You're saying the fence was built to be slow, not to be impenetrable.
That's the thing nobody outside the trade understands. We weren't building a wall that stops people. We were building something that delays them. The spec said the panels had to resist cutting for a certain number of minutes. Not forever, minutes.
How many minutes?
15. The test was a plasma cutter. The panel had to hold for 15 minutes against a plasma cutter. That was the standard. 15 minutes of cutting, and the panel was still structurally sound enough to slow someone down.
15 minutes. The entire border security concept rests on a 15-minute delay.
That's what the engineers designed for. 15 minutes is enough time for a sensor to trip, an alert to go out, and a response team to get moving. The fence doesn't stop anyone. It buys 15 minutes.
If the response team takes 20 minutes, the fence has failed.
The fence didn't fail. The system failed. The fence did what it was designed to do. It delayed. The problem was the response.
When you were inspecting those panels, you knew exactly what they were for. You knew the number.
15 minutes. I wrote it in the test report, I still have a copy somewhere, and I remember thinking, that's not very long, but the engineer said it was enough. The sensors would catch the breach, the response team would be there in 10 minutes, and the 15-minute spec gave a 5-minute buffer.
On October 7th, the response team wasn't there in 10 minutes.
No. And the breach wasn't one panel. It was dozens of panels, all at once, with bulldozers and explosives. The 15-minute spec was for a single cutter with a plasma torch.
The spec was based on a threat model that turned out to be wrong.
The spec was based on the threat model at the time. Smugglers, individual infiltrators, maybe a small group. Not a coordinated military assault with heavy equipment. Nobody designed that fence to stop a bulldozer.
But the Gaza barrier was designed to stop a bulldozer. It had the underground wall, the cut-resistant steel, the sensors, and it still failed.
Because the threat model changed again. The Gaza barrier was designed to stop tunnels. The attack came through the surface. You design for the last war, and the next war is different.
What's the lesson? Don't design for the last war.
The lesson is that any fixed barrier can be beaten. The only question is how long it takes. And if the response is slow, the barrier doesn't matter.
That's the thing I keep coming back to. The fence is a delay mechanism, and the delay only matters if the response is fast enough to use it.
The response is the hard part. The fence is easy. You pour concrete, you weld steel, you're done. The response is people, training, command and control, logistics. That's where it all falls apart.
When you were inspecting those panels, you were building the easy part.
I was building the easy part. The hard part was always the response. And the response is a human problem, not an engineering problem.
That's the thing I want to sit with. The engineering is impressive, but it's the easy part. The hard part is the human system that has to use the delay.
The human system is fallible. It gets overwhelmed, it gets confused, it gets slow.
I lost money on a bet about that fence. A colleague and I argued about whether it'd ever be breached. I bet it wouldn't. I lost.
How much?
50 shekels. But he never let me forget it.
When did you lose the bet?
The first time someone cut through a panel, I don't remember exactly when, a few years after we built it, someone came through with a torch and cut a hole big enough to crawl through. The sensors caught it, the response team got there, but the fence was breached. My colleague collected his 50 shekels.
The fence did its job. It delayed. The sensors detected. The response arrived. But it was still breached.
That's the thing. A breach isn't a failure. It's a data point. The question is whether the breach leads to something worse. If the response arrives in time, the breach is contained. If not, the breach becomes an incident.
On October 7th, the breaches became an incident.
The breaches became a catastrophe. Because the response failed. The fence did what it was designed to do. It delayed. But the delay wasn't enough, and the response wasn't there.
The engineering was sound, but the system failed.
The engineering was sound.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.